Okay, this is the 9/11 Truth and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference for 6/29/16. Ken Freeland facilitating, Craig McKee secretary, and we will proceed with the roll call. Go ahead, Craig.
Okay, I've collected a few names here, so I'll read who I know is on the call, and then we'll see who is missing. I have Barry Zwicker, Tim Fetzer, Jim Hufford, Craig McKee, Ken Freeland, Pat McGuire, Barbara Honegger, Wayne Costi, John O'Malley, Barton Bruce. So who have I not got?
Dave Schlesinger.
Dave Schlesinger, okay.
Dan Hennen.
Dan Hennen. Great.
Sheila.
Roger Borries.
Roger Borries and Sheila, did I hear?
Yes.
Okay, Sheila and Roger. Got it?
David Cole.
David Cole. Great. Is
okay.
That everybody?
Sounds like we've got everybody then, eh?
Yeah.
Okay, then our next item is always to approve the minutes as circulated with the draft agenda and then the draft minutes. Any objections to approving the minutes from the previous meeting?
I'd actually like to request about 1 minute to make a proposal about a way to deal with noise on the call.
That's coming up. We'll then get to direct in just a second. So we'll take the minutes as approved, and now we will
move
to the draft agenda. Sheila, you wanted to request a minute to talk about noise on the call. Okay.
Well, just to make a proposal, yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll put that earlier then, because we've got to take care of a housekeeping item first, and that's a housekeeping item, so we'll get that in right away. Any objections to giving Sheila a little bit of time to talk about that issue? Okay, hearing none, then we'll pick up that issue second, right behind the other housekeeping issue. Any other issues to be added or subtracted from the agenda, the draft agenda? Then we'll take the draft agenda for approved as amended and move forward to the first item, the first housekeeping item. Just to refresh everybody's memory, for those of you especially who were not on the last call, we had an incident where during one of the conversations, one of our participants, Robin Horton, made a personal comment about Craig McKee, and when asked to clarify, launched into such an invective that I had to cut it off, and later I requested that he consider making an apology. He said he would consider that, and about a week after the teleconference, I received a message addressed to myself and Craig entitled Parameters for an Apology, but it actually added insult to injury personally to me. More invective for Craig, and actually insults about the entire teleconference. So Craig has volunteered to request that we remove Robin from our list of invitees. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Thank you. Moved and seconded. Craig, do you want to move it forward real quick?
You've given a good sort of introduction. So, I mean, you know, I'm very not happy to be having to do this. I have no desire to do this kind of thing. But I think the thing with, and I don't really care whether Robin Horton apologizes to me personally or not. It makes no difference to me. But I think that what we see with Robin is a complete contempt for the teleconference itself. You know, he in this last email, which was also, I think, also went to Barbara and to Mark McCurtis, so it was a little less private than you know, than it might have been. But it also, I mean, he says in the email, he tells you to fuck off, I believe. Mm-hmm. Excuse my language, but I think that's worth noting since Ken is the facilitator of the teleconference. I think that's extremely disrespectful. He refers to the teleconference as being lame, a feeble enterprise, and you know, basically a bunch of old farts who don't, you know, who aren't achieving anything. You know, quite kind of. And I didn't realize that Robin was that much younger than the rest of us, but apparently.
I doubt it.
and you know, I mean, this is he repeated a lie that he had said on the conference as well, where he he accused me of promoting the idea that certain other truthers were affected by MK Ultra mind control, and that's why they had sort of changed their or become sort of chosen their positions on the Pentagon accordingly. And the fact was, I never said anything on the subject whatsoever. There was a remark made, but it wasn't by me. So he repeated this, even though I've explained this to him, he's repeated it anyway. So, so basically, I think that he's a toxic person on the teleconference. He was kicked out, I think, 2 years ago. Either that, or he sort of stomped off. I'm not really sure. He says he was fired, but he launched a bunch of insults against the teleconference then, and then he came back. And the thing I think is the last thing I'll just note is that this attack he launched on me last month, he says, I'll quote from the email, "I will make the point that my attack calling out McKee was pre-planned, carefully crafted, delivered at an appropriate time, clear and obvious as to my intent, and deliberately made obvious to everybody." So he was just waiting for an opportunity to do that, which had nothing to do with the discussion. So I don't think that he should be allowed to continue participating. So that's it.
Having seconded the proposal, I would simply add, with those attitudes, he ought to welcome his exclusion so he won't be wasting his time with this group of old buddies.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so are there any objections to removing Robin from the teleconference in this unit? Well, hearing none, then we'll just take it as approved by acclamation, and we will remove his name from the list of invitees and move on to the next item, which is Sheila, you wanted to talk about noise from the teleconference?
Yeah, hi. I've noticed that I've noticed that the noise on the line seems to be a real problem, and when I was doing my presentation about the Boston bombing, it seemed like I had to take a lot of time to out of my presentation to actually talk about the noise and trying to get people to shut off the noise. So I have an idea. I'm thinking that when we have noise like that, that's something that's really intrusive, that what we should do is ask everybody to unmute and basically go through everybody on the call one at a time and ask each person in order to mute their phone. And so we would sort of be taking roll, and sort of like, James Hufford, president accounted for, your time to mute. And then just go through each person in order. Because what I suspect is happening is people have it maybe on speakerphone. They're listening while they're doing something else, and they're getting involved in something else and forgetting about the fact that they still have it on speaker. And at the very least, that would isolate who the person is who's creating the noise and hopefully put some pressure on them to pay a little more attention in the future.
Okay, well, before you go further, Sheila, let me let you know that this actually can be done remotely, okay? I can actually mute everybody simultaneously or pretty quickly, and then unmute everybody one at a time to find out where the problem's coming from if we need to do that, okay? So that would hasten the process a little bit.
Oh, I didn't know that was possible. Well, is there any reason to say if somebody's making a presentation, you couldn't just go ahead and mute everybody except the person who's talking?
There is an except that, if we're in a discussion mode, then we don't want to mute everybody. But that can be done if I'm at the computer, which is the if. Normally I am. Sometimes I can't be at the computer, but if I'm at the computer, I can do it, yeah.
Okay. I guess I'm feeling a little surprised that maybe you haven't used that in the past, because it seems like there have been a few times when we've really been very much put out by a lot of noise on the line.
I may not have been at the computer at the time.
This is Barton.
Oh, okay.
Can I inject a couple of things about this?
Are you finished, Sheila?
Yes, I'm done.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, then.
One of the big pains with muting and unmuting is it takes a long time, because you have to be told this line is now muted as slowly as possible. Mm-hmm. And I assume a lot of people on the call, maybe not all, know what a binary search is. Ken could, in theory, mute the whole thing. If the software had the capability, or just something the vendor could add to it easily, you mute everybody except the person speaking. bank without wasting the time saying now everybody's muted, but they are. But people should know ahead of time this can happen. And then it unmutes half of the population. If the sound comes back, the problem's in that half. If it doesn't come back, the problem's in that half. You keep splitting it right down to the thing, and it's my research is for huge populations can happen extremely fast. If the software had that capability or they could be conned into doing it, that would solve the problem very fast. And if you get rid of the interruption saying what's happening, it could happen very fast and you just nail it down.
Yeah,
right.
I don't think that software is available on this teleconference.
This is Barb. I have a question about this. I like the idea of Ken being able to mute everybody but the speaker, as long as, for instance, if those of us who are all muted and listening suddenly can't hear anything, we need to be able to unmute individually.
Well, you can always unmute yourself. You can always unmute. All the mute does is just does the same thing as if you were muting yourself. You can always unmute with star six. Okay.
Well, then I don't see any reason why not to use that general feature.
Well, partly because we're often mostly in discussion mode, and when we're in discussion mode, there's no reason for anybody to be muted because, you know, you just want to chime in.
During debate or during... During a presentation that's already on the agenda by someone who's a sole speaker, I don't see why not.
Okay, so what we could do then is agree that somebody, when there is a presentation or a debate where there's no reason for others to involve, we should automatically all mute, or I'll mute anybody that doesn't remember to do it, and we'll hopefully be able to eliminate a lot of the noise that has been a problem from time to time. Is that a problem for anybody if we adopt that procedure? Again, I can only, I'm at the computer, but I'm usually at the computer, so that shouldn't be an issue. All right, well, thank you for that suggestion. It sounds like we have agreement on that, and we'll move forward to our first agenda item tonight, which is our book discussion, has been scheduled two months ago, on hidden finance, Conspiracy Theory in America by Lance DeHaven Smith. And I know James is here and Chad is here too, and myself, there's three of us for sure who have fully read the book, I hope, and others hopefully will be able to participate as well that have gotten hold of the book are familiar with its content. So James, would you like to just start us off, since you sort of gave us a little thumbnail sketch earlier, and you might want to refresh everybody's memory of what's in the book.
Okay, well, I can't remember exactly what I said before, but I'll try to say something halfway intelligible here. First of all, I think that this book is extremely valuable to read and deserves as wide an audience as possible, because if for no other reason, because it raises so many good issues, and I think about half the issues that it raises are things that at least I already sort of assumed, but to think of them, to kind of isolate them as points and deal with them one at a time really makes you think. And I think that whether you agree with this author on very many of these points or not, it's an extremely useful exercise to think about them and to realize that they are part of the sort of ongoing dialogue of conspiracy theories and just happenings in general, let's say deep state happenings in our country and in the world. Having said that, I think that he's off the beam in a few instances, in a few respects. One is that the reason that he doesn't cite for intra-government evasion of the law is really that there is a separate tiny controlling nation within a nation, and that thinks in many respects diametrically opposite to what the rest of the nation really thinks, and that they're not the patriots. He gives them credit for being patriots, but having a different idea of patriots. And I think that the only law that they adhere to is their own desire and their own agenda, and everything else be damned. That's what I think, anyway. So I don't think appeals to the Constitution would get anywhere. If they'll do what they want to do, and they have the power to get it done, and that's our problem. He accepts it. Let's see. Can't read my. I always write so, you know, on too small a paper, and I write too small, and I can't read my own writing, and that's my problem, I guess. But he fails to recognize that just this aspect that there's this deep state that really represents a tiny portion of the population that will get its way every single time. They just have the power to do so, and we have to overcome them. He doesn't mention Israel in the whole book. That's another fault. I think part of the problem in this country is that there's way too much influence coming from Israel, but he doesn't say anything about that. And his proposal, what he calls his proposal for reform, is actually that these instances of deep state crimes or state crimes need to be investigated forensically, just, you know, where they occur, just like any other crimes. And that's exactly a point that's been made by the 9/11 Truth community for 15 years now. That's nothing new at all. And of course, I hardly agree with him, but where has he been all this time? Because that's certainly not a new recognition, especially on our part, I don't think.
Okay, thanks, Jay. Kat, did you want to add anything?
Yes. I'd like to point people's attention to a New York Times article that was on Monday or Tuesday. It was a hit piece on conspiracy theorists. After Orlando, the article was saying how all this mention of false flags and crisis actors, and the conspiracy theorists are out in full force after Orlando. And then it went on to say, Benson thinks 9/11 is a conspiracy theory. Look at how crazy they are. And then the whole thing of crisis actors, they tried out the picture from Sandy Hook of the kids being ushered somewhere, you know, tear at people's heartstrings with children. It was just a really vicious hit piece. That if you're a thinking person, you could be asking questions. But most people, it quoted at least two, if not three, authors of books on conspiracy theory, in particular Brotherton, who is saying how there's something, people just need a psychological hook. And I'm surprised they did not quote Cass Sunstein, who is kind of trying to promote the thinking that maybe these conspiracy theorists need to be infiltrated.
this because they're dangerous. So it was just a very unfortunate hit piece because Lance Haven Smith was not mentioned at all. And his book clearly would be a counterpose, so it was totally one-sided hit piece that I want to say. And then I have, should I go on? I have another comment that maybe people want to see stuff before. This is a comment more about the end of the book where he talks about different things. So I think I'll hold my next comment for later and let people talk.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to say something. I mean, this is clearly a piece of propaganda. I mean, there's no question about it. The school, Sandy Hook, had been closed by 2008. There were no kids there. It was a two-day FEMA drill. We even have the manual. I made it the first appendix of the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, which was banned by Amazon.com. The photograph you're talking about was taken by the Newtown Lee photographer, Shannon Hicks. She took a second photograph, actually, earlier in time from further back.
Jim, excuse me for interrupting you, but right now we're just talking about the book, okay? You can talk about that other part when you do your presentation, okay, if you wish, because we don't want to talk about the New York Times article here. We want to talk about this book and anything related to the book, okay? Do you have any comments on this book?
No, I haven't seen the book.
Okay, thank you. Anybody who's read the book want to make a comment, or anybody who would like to know more about the book wish to make a comment?
Yeah, Barry Zwicker here.
Barry, go ahead.
Maybe could make a comment. I'm working on a review of it for Truth and Shadows,
mm-hmm.
and I read it some time ago, and then reread it lately. And of the many, many aspects that are sort of new to me, in a way, one is that this proven by reputable polling, this tremendous distrust, certainly through most of the Western world, in the elites, and this is well known to everybody on this call, must be well known to virtually everybody, how the rise of the populist parties shows that tremendous numbers of people don't believe in or support the existing elites. And I think that Lance Haven Smith in the book, he has a term called the super faction. And I guess that would be the deep state and so forth. And it appears that large numbers of people are intuiting this or seeing this outright. And so somehow this is a larger context for a discussion about this meme, conspiracy theory, conspiracy theorist, conspiracist that was injected into the public psyche deliberately by the CIA. We know that was done to try to fight off those who were skeptical about the Warren Commission. But we have a very different situation in the world today than existed in 1967. And it's just something I don't claim to have any special insight into, but I realize in writing a review of this book that this has to be taken into consideration. But I would just give one example. In the Globe and Mail this past Saturday, there's a columnist named Elizabeth Renzetti, and I actually admire her work tremendously. She has very privileged space in the Saturday Globe on page 2. And her headline in her column this past Saturday is, "Conspiracy Theorists Rejoice. Brexit Proves You Don't Need the Truth to Win." And I'll just quote her first paragraph and say a little about it and then leave it. She begins, "In case you missed it, MI5 totally screwed up the whole Brexit vote rigging thing. Britain's domestic spy service was supposed to spend the evening erasing the pencil-marked leave crosses on EU referendum ballots and replacing them with remain votes." And then now then comes such a typical mocking tone as you get with this kind of article that puts down so-called conspiracy theorists. She says, "I'm not sure what happened. Perhaps they forgot to hide enough of their erasers in the heels of their shoes," and so forth. And but she does go on to quote reputable polls. And then I went and looked at more polls from the Pew and Gallup and so on. And there's this tremendous number of people who just don't believe, for instance, the mainstream media. That's down to about 7% of the population. And so it's in that context that I look at this meme conspiracy theory and wonder to myself, is it losing, is there some point where it's going to lose its power through overuse and through the public seeing that over and over and over again the elites do lie to us?
Okay, that's
true. I think the answer is yes, and it's like these false flags. I've never seen such an outpouring of critiques taking apart, disentangling the claims about Orlando as occurred here. Hundreds of them. I mean, it's just astonishing. And I think with each of these, the public is becoming more aware, more skeptical, more open-minded about the so-called conspiracy theorists who might prefer to describe as conspiracy analysts or conspiracy realists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me get back to the book here. I'd like to make a comment. I'd like to take some issue with what James said, although I agree for the most part with his review. I think the key to understanding what Lance DeHaven Smith is proposing is that we take this idea of conspiracy theory and rework it so that it's more proactive and more acceptable. And will galvanize those very forces in the criminal justice system that are responsible for doing the forensic investigation of these kinds of state, what he calls state crimes against democracy. If instead of saying, I have a conspiracy theory about this issue, we said, I believe this is another state crime against democracy, and here's why, you know, which is what he's proposing that we consider to start doing with our verbiage, okay? It might precipitate a different take on some of these issues among some of the mainstream players, whose support we really do need if we ever are going to see criminal justice systems operate in the way they're supposed to, and to take on these crimes as they occur. And lend their forces to their investigation, which of course they're not doing now because they say, "Well, no, that can't be true. That's just a conspiracy theory," and so forth. You know, and they're being led to ignore what are their real responsibilities. But if they were rephrased in the way that Lance DeHaven Smith suggests, to the point where SCAD, Street Crimes Against Democracy, SCAD, becomes a household word, well, who knows? It might actually make some kind of a difference and help mainstream players get up their asses and do some work. You know, who knows? It's a thought.
Ken, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think you're right. I would like to add, though, that I think a lot of people these days are probably saying, oh, is that what a conspiracy theory is? I agree. If that's what it is, I agree. I'm a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah. So why use the words that the FBI or the CIA made up for us? Why not use words that have more impact?
Sure. We want to use the strongest language that we can to win the case. That's true.
This is Pat. I'd like to make a couple more comments about the book.
Go ahead, Kat. And then after Kat, I think we'll close out and move on to Jim Fester's presentation. Go ahead, Kat.
Okay. I have three basic points. One is I thought that his book really elevated the discussion when he looks at the political theory behind Popper, Beard, and and so it offers at a university level, the opportunity to truly analyze this from a sophisticated political analysis of what had happened.
Sociological, yes.
So I really appreciated that level of intellectuality given to this subject. And then also, at a whole other level, that really influenced me at this point, was the whole root of, I guess, the American Revolution, this whole patriot movement, in that it is our duty to constantly question, and we've totally just been inverted. And I really like the way he took examples from the American Revolution history, and those could be easily put into civics courses for the junior high and high school level quite easily. So I think the book lends itself to being a good textbook as well as just informative. And then I have one final comment to make. I appreciate it at the end where you showed how the things are undermined, like the stock puppets and obviously the media. And I'd like to point out one that maybe people haven't thought of too much, of how we as activists get kind of marginalized in a conspiracy theory way, and that has to do with design. Now, you might think, design, what's that got to do with it? But, for example, I tried to show a colleague the Architects and Engineers website, and he looked at it, and he was like, anything that looks that cheap, and actually theirs is one of the better ones, but anything that looks that cheap. And so what has happened is through Apple, MTV, they've raised the bar of what looks professional and credible. And as poor activists, when we don't now meet the bar for design, the superficial presentation layer, then it's suspect. Or conversely, sometimes if it's really poor, then you must believe it. But it's like if we came out wearing scruffy clothes or something, and yet the bar's so high, you can afford to look slick and have our same message, but look in a way that people are really used to. And so I think that's another way that's undermined that he didn't quite capture. I don't think people have really caught on to yet as activists how we are dismissed because we the bar for design and presentation has really been raised, and we're sort of like we've been especially we can't reach people because they don't want to hear that.
Okay, well, Kat, I want to thank you for making at least those first two comments, because I too was really taken in by his very high academic approach to this. And I was so entranced by what he had to say about Beard that I ordered some of Beard's books. It's odd that I had not been exposed to Beard in the course of my own sociological training, but I had not. And he really, it was worth reading for anybody that wants to take the time to understand how conspiracy theory was very accessible at one time in America, because his taking a part of the Constitution as an academic document, and which classes were benefited from me, and so forth, are the mainstay of conspiratorial theory insofar as it has an economic underpinning. So I would encourage people that are interested in. I'm sorry, am I still on?
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Sorry, just lost your foot. I would encourage people that are interested in the subject to do the same thing and get some of Beard's American history, because it's well worth reading. And his wife, too, Mary Beard, I guess she was part of his presentation of history, his representation of history.
And
so
I've got a quick comment, Barb.
Okay, Barb, go ahead.
Yeah, a question for Kat and then a quick comment regarding how to win against the deep state use of conspiracy theory to mock us, etc., which has been incredibly successful. I think that what we need to do more of is to turn it around on the deep state, because when we make the point that the official conspiracy, that the official story is a conspiracy theory, and the only difference is it's a false conspiracy theory. The question isn't that the government doesn't have a conspiracy theory. It comes up as conspiracy theories all the time. It's just that they're absurdly false, and they provably false. So I just think we should turn it around. We should do some jujitsu. And then my question to Kat was, Kat, have you sent a link to that very important New York Times article to everybody on the list through the 9/11 telephone, number one? And number two, is there a place where on the website, the New York Times page for the article, that you can make comments, which is usually the case, and if so, we all should.
Right. I was going to suggest that we all tell, if we can make comments, I sent the link to Ken already, so Ken has it, but if you can make comments, I highly suggest every Wednesday, read Nancy's comments, so you at least get two sides of this day in court.
This is Sheila. Can I add something?
Yeah, make it quick, Sheila, please.
Okay. First of all, no, you can't add comments. I checked. And I wanted to say that I think that one aspect about conspiracy theory that people keep harping on, which I don't think does us any good at all, is trying to point out that 19 Muslims bringing down the towers is also a conspiracy theory. That is completely ignoring the fact that the difference between denotation and connotation of a phrase, and it's not really the denotation of conspiracy theory that we need to be concerned about, it's the connotation.
Mm-hmm.
The denotation does in fact mean that any group of people getting together to do harm is a conspiracy. And but nobody cares about that. They have a different meaning. People have a different thing in mind when they say conspiracy theory. And what they mean is exactly what we're doing, which is a conspiracy that is perpetrated by people in high places and the government. So I don't think we get any mileage at all out of pointing out that Muslims bringing down the towers is also a conspiracy. It just doesn't wash. It doesn't get us anywhere.
Okay, and I think that's been a very productive discussion. Dave, sorry, you have to make it very quick because we're out of time on this issue. Like just a few seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, I make a separate point on the idea of a conspiracy being being taken as a put down implies that people in power would never abuse their power. And I bring up the Lord Acton quote, and power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Good point. Okay, so we're ready now. Thank you all for your participation on that one. And we'll move on now to three presentations by Jim Fetzer. He's going to speak on three different topics, and in the interest of time, he'll make his three presentations, and then we'll be open for questions and answers on any of the three. That may be a little confusing, but it's only because of the shortness of time, and I appreciate Jim's willingness to do it this way so that we can condense the question and answer period. Jim?
Thanks, Ken. Alas, I have to leave at the top of the hour, so I'll be very concise.
Okay.
You had a discussion with a fellow named Mark from Boston who was claiming there was lots of documents to substantiate that there was a Jeff Bauman. The question isn't whether there is a Jeff Bauman, but which Jeff Bauman he would be talking about. Unless he adduced a photograph, we don't know, because there are at least three different parties who have been produced as Jeff Bauman. On the scene of the Boston bombing was Jeff Bauman, number one, who had his leg missing below the knee and a missing left finger on his little finger on his hand. The Jeff Bauman, number two, is missing his legs from above the knee at the Boston Bruin game. Only 19 days later, has all of his fingers. Jeff Bauman, number three, has no legs at all, not even thighs, and he's rolled out at a baseball game by none other than Carlos Arredondo, who is an actor identified by Nathan Foulkes, who interestingly pointed out to me that he thought they also had used a smoke machine. So we have, if you look through Sheila has done such good work on this, you look through the smoke there, and there are bodies that are missing body parts, but there is no blood. These were amputee actors. The blood shows up later. It's Hollywood blood. The smoke actually came from a smoke machine. I was so astonished when we had a photograph of it. I put it on the back of the book, and nobody died in Boston either. Qualified, meaning at the marathon, nobody died, because one of the brothers, the older brother, Tamerlan, appears to have been run over by the police. There was a security guard at MAT to whom I believe Zoker was seeking to turn himself in, who appears to have been murdered, and then a friend of the brothers was shot to death by the FBI. So we have a point about to clarify about the title on the copyright page. Turning to the second 9/11, the who, the how, and the why, this is the prologue to a new book I'm editing about 9/11, America Noosed on 9/11, compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the DOD, and the Mossad. And the book will be out next month. Now, it's 460-plus pages. I'm completing the index now. It has hundreds of photographs. It has 14 or 15 contributors. And the point I want to make here is that it's very comprehensive. It has 8 parts with 3 chapters in each part, plus a preface and a prologue, and then an afterword and an epilogue. And I'm going to suggest that this might be a great target book for 9/11 research. Frequently, we get lost because we don't know what specific claims are being addressed. I'm going to suggest here we have a specific set of claims, specific set of authors, specific set of arguments that would make a marvelous target. There's a very famous journal called Behavioral and Brain Sciences that has long since adopted the practice of having a target article and then inviting commentators on the article. It's worked out brilliantly. I think this book might serve such a function in turn. And the third is regarding Barbara's work on Behind the Smoke Curtain. I was a little troubled by the fact that at the end of her presentation, she is dismissive about my arguments that no plane actually hit the South Tower, or the North for that matter. She says that just because I find inconsistencies in the videos, but that's simply indefensible. I'm talking about the physics of the situation. You have an aluminum airliner that's in the first place, according to the videos, traveling faster than would be aerodynamically possible. Pilots for 9/11 Truth have established that a Boeing 767 at that altitude, at that speed, would physically come apart. You're talking about a collision between an aluminum airliner and a massive 500,000-ton steel and concrete structure with a lattice design where each of the floors represented an acre of concrete on a steel truss. It's simply indefensible to think that a real plane could actually enter the building in that instance. But that's regarding her throwaway line at the end of her presentation in response to a question. More significantly, I've long since been troubled by Barbara's repeated use of the word plane to describe whatever hit the Pentagon. And it does appear that something did hit the Pentagon. But the fact is, she seems to be combining a flyover that was intended to create the impression that a real plane had hit the Pentagon with a small shards of white fiberglass from what appears to have been a Global Hawk that actually hit the building. Those two events aren't linked. She's wrongly asserting that a full-size passenger jet of white color struck the building, but the wreckage debris on the field doesn't support a full-size airliner impact, which would have been a 100-ton plane. There is not more than a ton's worth of crash debris anywhere, and more importantly, the white shards of fiberglass can't come from an airliner because airliners aren't made of white fiberglass. Now, my conversation here, discussion, was with Dennis Camino, who has several chapters in the book and whom I regard as the leading expert on the Pentagon. So if there's a need for a debate, I'd highly recommend Dennis Camino. But that's a short take on the 3 items on my agenda. Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you, Barb. I'd like to comment, Barbara.
Okay, Barbara, who else would like to be on the stack to make a comment or ask a question?
Dave Schlesinger.
Dave, who else? Okay, I'll put myself last. Go ahead, Barb.
Yes, I don't know if anybody's seen this already, but just when the call started, I sent my rebuttal to Jim Fetz's entire third show with Dennis Camino that he just mentioned. Jim Fetzer is completely misstating the position of the smoke curtain, and I proved that in the email that I sent to everyone. People just need to read it. In fact, the irony of the Dennis Camino interview is that Dennis Camino and I agree about what happened at the Pentagon. And Dennis Camino agrees with me that it was not, as Fetzer misstates, and I think he knows he's misstating smoke curtain, Fetzer misstates repeatedly that I claim that a 757 or a large Boeing airliner was destroyed at the Pentagon. He even used just the word hit. Explicitly, the whole purpose of that section of smoke curtain is to argue against an impact on the Pentagon. And I make clear, like Dennis Cimino does, we agree, Dennis Cimino and I, that it was a remote control plane that was made of fiberglass, that it was white, that the debris, that the plane wreckage near the heliport, which is further to the left or north than the official story alleged impact point, was from a plane that was mocked up to appear to be an airliner. Jim Stetson knows all this. But anyway, I just refer you to my detailed rebuttal with the times and minutes into Fetzer's interview with Cimino, and read it for you.
Well, just to make sure I had Dennis straight, I had him give me a summary of the his critique of your work. I was quoting from his summary when I gave that summary, so you seem to have missed the point, Barbara.
I don't miss anything, Barbara. She keeps describing
an unmanned aerial vehicle as a plane. I've been after her since the Vancouver hearings in 2012 to cease that practice. She continues to
now you're just making an argument about what words are used. You know darn well that I do not say that a 757 hit that building. You know it.
I invite anyone to take a look at the discussion I had with Dennis, which I was citing here. Barbara is grossly distorting. She uses the word blame all the time to describe something
that's not... No, Fetzer is distorting. Fetzer is distorting. See my email.
Okay.
See my email.
I think we're not going to be able to have a full-fledged debate here, so... I would encourage people to take a look at Barbara's email, consider what Jim has said, and if it turns out that we have an option down the pipe to do a genuine debate, maybe we'll consider opening the for that. So
We don't need a debate. Cimino and I agree on what happened at the Pentagon.
Okay.
Barbara, I'm just summarizing Dennis's position. You want me to read the whole email?
Just read my email, everybody.
Barbara, you're really a bit much, and to imply that I'm stating something I don't believe is offensive and deplorable.
You are defensive and deplorable, Jim Fetzer. Your style is defensive and deplorable, and you make false statements.
Come on, this isn't productive. I realize that we have differences here. These people just read Barbara's email, consider what Jim has said, and draw your own conclusions.
Your own conclusions. Thank you.
Yes, I wanted to raise a brief discussion of the Boston bombing. I certainly support the truth of position that the official story is a lie, and I'm not a researcher, but I'm originally from Maryland, and my dear friend had cited evidence that he saw that somebody from Maryland was injured there, and I'm hoping to find somebody who would like to research that further to see if that is true.
Look,
we don't say that that's not possible, but I'm just curious if anybody's willing to look at that.
Look, it was a pop piece. I'm a former artillery officer. There was noise in the sound, but there wasn't explosive force to kill anybody. I have a 440-page book on this with 350 photographs, and nobody died in Boston either.
I'm not saying she died. I'm just asking, can I correspond with you about this assertion in the newspapers in Maryland?
Sure, absolutely.
Great.
Anytime.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for this opportunity. I'm sorry that I have to depart for this other
show. Dave, before you go, Jim, I have a question too, okay?
All right, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Do you deny then, based on your evidence that you've talked about the being different Jeff Bauman, that there was a Jeff Bauman who lost his legs in that?
Well, the question is who was it? The first Jeff Bauman appears to have been the first lieutenant, Army lieutenant, by name of Nick Boyd, who happened to lose his legs and below the knee and his little finger on his hand in Afghanistan. So, you know, figure out who they are. What you have is three different actors, and I'm sorry that Paul couldn't be here, because I understand he has questions about crisis actors, whether they were used in Boston. There isn't any doubt about it. Lorraine Dang, who was the chief of trauma surgery at San Francisco General Hospital.
Jim, my question is very pointed. Do you deny that there was a Jeff Bauman who lost his legs in the Boston bombing or not? Yes or no?
Well, it's not obvious to me. I mean, there's a person who was called Jeff Bauman, but who was that, you know? It appears to have been Nick Voigt. And the fact that there's some documentary record for Jeff Bauman is meaningless. The CIA specializes in fabricating
the evidence that was circulated by Mark McCurtis shows that there are individuals named who say that they work with and their pictures and everything, they worked with him, you know, the week before. He was walking around on two legs like you and me, and then they saw him in the hospital without his legs. Same guy. So
nobody lost any limbs, and it was complete fake. There's no doubt about it. Look at any of my stuff. Look at the real deal special Boston bombing update. Look at the, you know, I mean, it's so blatant. Anyone who's looked at the case, I think, can't have any doubts. But I'm sorry I can't stay longer and argue in greater detail.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your presentation, Jim.
Nobody died at the marathon. Nobody lost any limbs. They used amputee actors. They used Hollywood blood. They used a smoke machine, which is why the subtitles state-sponsored terrorism with Hollywood special effects. Thank you all for allowing.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for your presentation and your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right. Let's move on then to
I would like to say something past this last one.
Yeah, I'll take you this later, but of course Jim's not here to respond at this point, but try to make it brief, please. Go ahead. Go ahead. Did you want to say something? Well, I thought that was Sheila, but I guess I don't know what happened there. All right, well, we'll move on then. Okay, so I have a quick book review of Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks and Secret Sorcery, The Fascist International, 9/11, and Penetrated Operations by Joseph T. Farrell. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Joseph Farrell, but he's written a number of quite cogent and commanding books on subjects related to the survival of a Nazi international and a number of issues related to 9/11. I'm going to just review very quickly this review of this book, and if you have any questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, we can move on to the next item. Farrell's latest book is absolutely must reading for everybody seriously involved in 9/11 truth research. He is the first to propose a theory of the events of 9/11 as a penetrated false flag operation. In brief, Farrell posits three tiers of the operation. The first tier would be that which we truthers commonly refer to as the official narrative or the OTC, the official conspiracy theory. You know the routine, 19 Arab box cutters, hijackers with the box cutters directed by Osama bin Laden. The second tier would be that to which we refer by the slogan 9/11 was an inside job. All the state actors, with or without official or formal sanction, who necessarily were involved to facilitate the event and to assure cover-up. The third tier is what marks his theory as unique and original. He claims that the second tier was penetrated by another group of actors who announced their divorce from the second tier by a dramatic overkill, overextension of the PSYOP, and actually threatened the second tier directly and indirectly by advertising their intimate penetration of U.S. command codes up to and including nuclear missile launch codes. Without either endorsing or challenging his theory, it must be acknowledged that it accounts very effectively for certain anomalies in the events of 9/11 that are otherwise ignored or unexplained by other 9/11 conspiracy theories. For example, why did Bush sit calmly in the Florida classroom for quite a while, then suddenly rush helter-skelter to Air Force One? Why did he announce that he would be returning directly to Washington officially, but instead make whistle stops at Barksdale and off at Air Force bases? What about the critical threatening phone call that threatened Air Force One and revealed intimate knowledge of U.S. command codes? And Bush's call to Putin? What was that about? All of it makes perfect sense according to Farrell's theory.
The treason is planned to allow a limited false flag operation has been hijacked by a third party and ramped up to demonstrate its superiority and intelligence, and the original traitors were in state of siege, having lost control of the entire military apparatus. Of course, Cheney's long disappearance after the fact fits neatly into the scenario. For more of these details, you just need to read the book yourself, which I urge you to do. But I will tell you who Farrell names as that third party, which will come as no surprise to anyone familiar with his earlier work. The transplanted and revivified Nazi Empire, a transnational fascist entity that, according to some estimates, has trillions of dollars at its disposal and significant and possibly highly advanced technological capacity. Whether the suspicion is well-grounded or not depends on the credibility you lend to his earlier research on the subject, as we won't take time here to examine it. Let me say that one of the strengths of his book is his sober review of the prevailing theories of the destruction of the World Trade Center and how none of them is truly adequate, and how all have created controversy and often division within the 9/11 truth movement. A penetrated false flag operation might explain why different levels of destructive technology might have been simultaneously deployed. It's as good a theory as any to explain the sometimes contradictory findings in operations. The weakness of the book is in the chapter which answers to the last part of the title of this book, called Secret Sorcery. Not for the first time, Farrell strives to prove that various numerological and other devices are clearly in evidence in 9/11, demonstrating an occult motive in its perpetration. I find his arguments here uncompelling and wish he had excised this entire chapter from the book and had spent more time pursuing his art. Is everybody else hearing an echo?
Yes.
Yeah, something.
There's some kind of background, like a radio or something in the background. Okay. It has spent more time pursuing his arguments about the types of exotic technology which he suggests might have sufficiently explained the unique structure of the Twin Towers without providing much in the way of positive evidence of their existence. Notwithstanding, I believe his theory of a penetrated false flag operation, which, by the way, he compares in detail to the JFK assassination, deserves the full consideration of the 9/11 truth community and will take its place alongside the other major explanations that have been offered to explain what remains the most unfathomable mystery of our time. Okay. Anybody have any comments or questions about the book?
Yeah, Barb, I do.
Barbara? Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Oh, what's that? Anybody else?
Cat does.
Sorry, who else?
Cat.
Okay. Anybody besides Barb and Cat?
Sheila on the sack. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now, Barbara.
I don't know what happened before. Did you not hear me?
Yeah, you just after you said you wanted to speak before, and I gave you the opportunity. We couldn't hear anything. You just
okay.
Yeah, you must have unmuted yourself without realizing it. Okay, so I'm thinking that you probably just hung up and called back, which is one way of clearing
it
out.
No, well, I just switched to a different phone.
Oh yeah, okay, okay. You were okay. So Barb, Kat, and Sheila. Anybody else?
James.
I want to speak. James, who else? Okay. Barb, go ahead.
I have a question and then a comment. My question that some people can answer later is, I've tried to get this book, and I know that Ken is reading from an excellent review of the book on Amazon.com. There are quite a few reviews.
That was my own review. Barbara, that was my own review. I wrote that review.
Thank you. Yes, I know. But it's on Amazon.com. Yes. I responded to that on Amazon.com so people could go look. But my question is, I tried to order the book from Amazon.com, and it's taken forever, and I don't have it. Then I went to Farrell's website, JamesFarrell.com, I think it is, tried to order it there, couldn't find it there. So I'm trying to get the book. So my question for later after my comment is, has anybody actually obtained the book, and how did you obtain it?
I ordered it from Amazon, and it came right through.
Yeah, I think I got it from Amazon as well.
Okay. All right. Well, mine hasn't arrived yet. Okay. Well, anyway, my comment is this. It's interesting. I think James Farrell has used different language. It's not a unique and new theory at all. The idea that a plot was probably ginned up by infiltration into Al-Qaeda or everybody, that there probably was a proposed bomb, and that the alleged hijackers were protected, as you know, this is the 28 pages and such, by the Saudis and the CIA and the FBI at the highest level, and that the original so-called false flag level that he talks about was the letting it happen on purpose. But we've known for almost just a decade and a half that LIHOP was infiltrated with a MIHOP that the military exercises that Chester goes in, not Chester, that Terrell goes into in some detail in the book, as the modus operandi for infiltrating
we're getting really bad background noise here. Does anybody know where that might be coming from? They can mute their phone, star six, please, if you have background noise. Okay, I think that's a fair way to take it over. Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that I think I'm trying to get the book. I can't comment more except for one thing I'll mention in a moment that I can comment on that I know. And that is that it's not a new proposal. It's not unique and it's not new. But I think it is probably an important book. That's number one. But number two, Terrell is apparently not aware of Behind the Smoke Curtain, because one of the things that he asks and makes a big deal about, according to Ken's review that's on Amazon.com that he just read, which is excellent, is what Terrell asked, well, you know, why did Bush sit in the classroom until he actually left the classroom about 9:15 and went into the short press conference at 9:30 and was whisked out by the Secret Service at 9:32. Well, Terrell is apparently not aware of two critical facts, and that's in my response to Ken's review on Amazon.com in my own review comment, and that is that Bush was whisked out by the Secret Service literally after the real, actual, early time of the real first explosion at the Pentagon, which was by April Gallup's death, and then the destruction of a plane near the helipad at a little bit after 9:32, right after the destruction of a plane at the helipad, at the heliport, and Terrell apparently doesn't know that that's exactly where Bush was pre-scheduled to land at the Pentagon heliport around noon. So of course he's not going to go to the Pentagon after the very place his Marine Corps One was going to land a few hours after he was in Florida. And when the Secret Service finally, right after the actual early time of the real first Pentagon explosion, the Secret Service suddenly whisked him out of the Florida school and acted as if it were suddenly a real terrorist attack that might have something to do with the president, and acted as if they were afraid that Bush was actually going to be assassinated, took a zigzag path out of schedule to Air Force One at the Sarasota Air Base, and went up without even a fighter escort, landed at Barksdale, which gave Bush time for his own Texas Air National Guard planes, the only ones he trusted in the entire country, to arrive at Barksdale and then escort him off at Air Force Base. And then he went from office back to Washington for his speech in the evening. So Terrell's just not aware of some of these critical facts about the timing of the Pentagon attack and the real reason that Bush didn't return to Washington.
Okay, well, Barbara, I think some of your criticism is well-founded, but I think other parts of it, I don't think you quite understand his theory. And, of course, I don't have time to do it justice here, but it's really not, as you presented it, it's not the typical LIHOP tip to end to something else, go live. It's much different from that. It's more like a MIHOP that was hijacked, okay?
I understand that.
It's quite novel. He's using new
language to talk about something that's been out since August.
No, he's not. He's actually presenting a new theory. But you have to read the book to see what happens.
Yeah, well,
okay.
I've been trying, and once I get the book, I will do a detailed analysis.
I'm sorry you're having trouble getting it. Okay. Kat, you're next.
Yes, and I have not read the book, but I've listened to several podcasts with Dr. Farrell. And I'm concerned that he does similarly with what David Felder does, another very good book, The Devil's Chessboard. It's very easy to point the finger at the Nazis, and I want all Nazi information to come out. But they go all the way up to the edge, and there's zero talk about Israel and Zionists, who have collaborated in the past and probably continue to collaborate with Nazis. And for all the research he did into Nazis, to not even have, I mean, I haven't read the book, but I don't believe there's any mention of Israelis, if it's anything like that.
Yeah, there is mention of Mossad involvement, for sure. Yeah.
But deep involvement or tangential?
Probably at the second tier, but I would assume.
Yeah, see, that's really wrong. It would be the third tier, and they go all the way up to the edge, and then
well,
they
Well, of course, that's not his theory, right? His theory is that it was a different entity that was responsible. So, yes, of course, you're presenting an alternative theory of who's ultimately responsible.
Right, this is Barb. I agree with Kat. By pointing the finger at Nazis as his ultimate bad guy, he is pointing the finger directly away from who we know had to be involved at the highest hijack level of the internal plot, and that's the Zionists.
Okay, is that your... Are you here to say that? Anything else?
No, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Sheila, you're there?
Okay, I think at this point in time, we should stop thinking that any witnesses... In other words, any personal testimony really means anything at all, because I think it's become extremely obvious that our opponents can pay off anyone they want to say whatever they want them to say. And or they can simply put people in positions where they, place them years in advance, so they'll be in that position at the time when the event occurs.
What does this have to do with the book?
This is the reply I wanted to give to you. This has to do with your question to Jim Fetzer about...
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you wait on that? Because we're doing the book right now. Then when we're done with the book, I'll go back and give you a chance to...
Well, can you give me the name, your name on Amazon, and I'll read your review then, because I missed the whole thing messing with the phones.
I see. Okay, well, this is a review...
What's your name on Amazon? I'll read your review.
Oh, Ken Freeland?
You have it under your own name?
Yeah.
Really?
Some of us do.
Because I've been scanning through them here, and I don't see a Ken Freeland's here.
Yeah, I don't think it's under your name, Ken, but I could be wrong.
Oh. Well, I wasn't even aware that I published it on Amazon.com. That's kind of odd. But,
do you remember what your title was?
Yeah, the title is Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery. Okay.
No, the title of your review. That's the title of the book.
No, I sure don't.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm scanning through them, and I don't see anything with your name.
Yeah, I don't remember putting it up on Amazon.com. I don't know how that got there, but maybe I did it after my interview or something. So we're going to come back to you, Sheila, after James talks on this subject. Go ahead, James.
Well, I remember several years ago reading a theory that the actual named terror, well, like something like maybe controlled, but the designated terrorists actually did come up with the theory of flying into the buildings, and that was taken over and added to, just sort of added on to the blow up the buildings and so on by the deep state powers that be. And in that way, it was a kind of at least a two-tier process, if that were to be true. And the other thing is that old back Webster Tarpley's book, way back in about 2004-2005, was talking a lot about the codes and so forth that nobody else since that I'm aware of has really picked up on. And I'm glad to know that Farrell has, at least.
Yes, and Farrell acknowledges his debt to Tarpley in that respect as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so then if that's it for this subject will give Kat an opportunity to make her earlier response that she wasn't able to make because apparently she got muted. So go ahead, Kat.
I think you meant
Sheila.
I'm sorry, Sheila. I beg your pardon. I meant Sheila. I'm sorry, Sheila.
Oh, okay. Thanks. Yeah, so you had asked Jim Fetzer, apparently, Ken, you found it very compelling that there were photographs of Costco employees evidently signing sympathy cards and that kind of thing for Jeff Bauman. Is that what you were referring to?
They not only were signing sympathy cards, but they had visited him in the hospital, so they were affirming that it was the same person.
Right. Well, I think what I want to say about this is that I don't feel at this point in time that we should be giving any credence at all to personal testimony because it seems abundantly clear that our fascist overlords are capable of paying off and manipulating almost anybody they want to. When you look at this last or this most recent Orlando event, which I am now about 99% sure is a hoax, they have doctors that they've been able to place into the Orlando Regional Medical Center. And at least they're posing as doctors. They have names like Dr. Cheatham and Dr. Lube, and I think that's all meant to be a joke. And none of these doctors have any reviews or any history prior to just this bombing, or rather this shooting. But I feel, and I see the same thing, say, with the Virginia shooting, which I researched quite extensively because I live in Virginia, and I know that was also a hoax. And so you ask, well, where did these people... I don't know about that one. I didn't research that one, really.
Oh,
but I can't say either way. So I simply feel that we have to look at evidence that cannot be easily manipulated. People can be easily manipulated. That is abundantly clear. We've got our entire Congress that has been manipulated. We have so many people in positions of power who could be speaking out about this and are not, and I assume that's because they're manipulated, either with threats or with money. And I think if you can manipulate congressmen, you can easily manipulate Costco employees, or how hard would it be to simply have a few CIA operatives get jobs at Costco and just be there for 18 months or so until the time comes when it's time for them to do what they were put there to do. So I don't find any kind of personal testimony at this point coming from the other side to be at all compelling because they have the power to manipulate people. Personal testimony coming from our side I do find compelling because we don't have that kind of power. We don't have that kind of money.
Yeah, I think I think you made your point, okay? Because we need to move on. But I wanted to make sure you had an opportunity to say what you had to say there. And I'll just make a brief response, if I may.
Sure.
I think, you know, people are innocent until proven guilty, and it's fine to come up with theories about why personal testimony may not be valid, but you got to prove it, okay? You can't just say it. You got to prove it. And I think we have
proved it.
No.
We've proven that things happened at that event that are physiologically impossible.
If there was a real Jeff Bauman who really lost his legs, none of that matters, Sheila. It doesn't make any difference. If there wasn't, then disproving these testimonies...
I don't think you understand the evidence, Ken.
I don't think you understand the evidence because you're not willing to discredit it, okay?
Well, Ken,
if you were willing to discredit this article, then I would take your word for it, but you're not even willing to look at it.
Which article are you talking about?
The one with these witnesses, the people that worked at the Costco with him and visited him in the hospital and said it was the same guy, okay?
It's just not credible, you know, not compared to what we have.
But it's credible to me, so we could sit here and go back and forth about this, but that's not going to be productive. Somebody's got to do research. Who's going to do
okay.
that? Okay.
Okay, Ken, let me say this one thing to you. I think you need to understand this. It is not physiologically impossible to lose both your legs at the knee, have no medical attention, be sitting up, and be fully conscious, and not be bleeding, and not be, at that point he would be dead.
Yeah.
You don't lose both your legs at the knee and have no medical attention, and no applied tourniquet, and 8 minutes later you're sitting up in a wheelchair. It's just not physiologically impossible.
I know there are some anomalies in those photographs, but those are just photographs, okay? I'm talking about the
No, it's not. It's not just photographs. I took the video and there it's time stamped, and I was able to put it all in order that based on the time stamped video.
All right. Okay. Well, okay. Fine. I'm just saying that, you know, when somebody says that they found a passport on the bottom of the World Trade Center, we don't say, well, that's irrelevant. We discredit it. We show why it can't be valid. And nobody's willing to take the time to do that with these newspaper articles, which pretty much substantiate the Jeff Baum story. So that's, I just want to, I think we need to move on, okay? Thank you, though. Okay, so our next item is James wants us to discuss. Take the floor, James. It's yours, okay?
Okay. Okay, well, I may have, or I don't know if these are my words or whose words, but it says a group investigation to determine U.S. creation and support and guidance of ISIS. Well, all I meant by that was a group discussion, because I think probably the one key thing that could piece of information, if it were widely known, if it were widely enough disseminated beyond people that already know it, into the general public and far into the general public, that would really change things in this country as far as public perceptions go, would be the realization that would be backed up with some sort of proof that that the U.S. intelligence created ISIS and controlled ISIS as an asset, just as was the case with Al-Qaeda, and certainly was the case even more clearly with Gladio before that. If people realize that yes, we need to fear ISIS or whatever it's called, but that we really need to fear more the sponsors of it, which are deep in our own government, that would turn things around. They wouldn't take seriously all of these false flag operations that keep taking place, all these bombings and shootings and everything around the world and across this country that have people so shook up now. Their first inclination should be to say, oh, was that real? I'm not sure. You have to convince me, because I don't think it was. And how do we do that? How if we're just as activists, are we real activists, or are we just monitors? I mean, if we're activists, we need to think about questions like this and discuss and trade ideas, come up, do a little bit of soul searching about how we get that message out most effectively and most widely. And that's what I'm concerned about.
Okay. Who would like to comment for?
Dave Schlesinger.
Dave?
Barb.
Who else? All right, I'll put myself last. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, I'm very interested in this issue. 2 years ago, I was invited to write a peer-reviewed paper for an online journal, and I'm not a researcher, and I have not followed through yet. But part of that paper would deal with the issue of the jihadist movement being infiltrated by Western intel. So I would very much like to be in dialogue with whoever is interested in looking further at this issue.
Okay. Barb?
People may already know of this book, but I highly recommend it. I believe it's only a Kindle e-book on Amazon so far. Wayne Mattson has a book on Kindle on Amazon called ISIS Is Us. ISIS Is Us. I highly recommend getting it.
Yeah.
It's not long, and it's very well documented. And if you owned a few copies or even made not that long Xeroxes, you could pass them out to key opinion leaders. That's one. And number two, into it in more detail during the announcement section, and I'm on the organizing committee for the upcoming major worldwide New York conference on the 15th anniversary. And we have just received, and it's very exciting, actually I extended the invitation and he accepted it, to Judge Ferdinando Impazzinato, the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Italy, will be speaking in New York on September 10th and 11th, that's the weekend.
Right.
So I'll go into more of this, but he of course is the investigative magistrate in Italy who then rose to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He still has the honorific title President of the Supreme Court of Italy, and he personally investigated and successfully prosecuted the Gladio operation on the
Yeah, Barbara, I'd like to say that I have Madsen's book, and I agree, that's an excellent resource. One thing to be aware of, if you're looking it up on Amazon, though, is that there is a apparently an electronic version and a print version that are basically the same content, but under different titles. So if you run into the electronic version first, and you're like me, you got to have a book in your hand, look a little farther, and you'll find the print version, and you can order that.
Well, what's the title of the print version, please?
Oh boy, I don't have it here with me. But
okay, well, the Kindle version is I Teach Us, and
you can find it on Amazon if you just look up Wayne Madsen's author page, you should be able to find both.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. I would refer to the discussion that sometimes it's a question of what's the most credible evidence. As I think you and I have gone back and forth about the question of how well this information already reached the awareness level within the alternative movement, James,
sure.
And I think it's pretty saturated. But the question is what would make it come alive for people outside of our inner circles. And to my mind, the most credible witness I've run into is Scott Bennett, okay? I don't know if you've heard any of his interviews, but...
What's his name?
Scott Bennett.
Bennett, okay.
Yeah. He
former Army intelligence.
Yeah. He was in a jail cell with a former... accountant of sorts that got into trouble with his deep state supporters, and learned from him that there was all of this evidence that the Swiss bank accounts were being used as conduits between various parts of the U.S. Deep state and ISIS. His book is about that. I think I'd recommend people get a hold of it. I don't have the title handy.
It's called Shell Game.
Shell Game, thank you. Shell Game.
Oh,
I think I have a copy. But what was I going to say? I lost my train of thought there.
You were saying to talk the best sources with Scott Bennett.
Well, I guess what I was going to suggest is, that what might be considered is to get that guy to go on tour and, go around the country and give his evidence. By the way, I know what I was going to say. The fellow who he was in jail with ended up getting a $100 million, if I'm not mistaken about that figure, a $100 million payoff. Supposedly, as whistleblower money, but actually as sort of a payoff to keep him quiet. That's what Scott Bennett thinks. Okay.
And his name is Brad Birkenfeld.
Brad Birkenfeld, that's right. And so this kind of evidence seems to me to be the kind of thing that might wake some people up that are open to evidence of that sort if they heard it from at least the second-hand level from Scott Bennett. Who actually had to spend the time in prison to find this stuff out. So, I mean, that's just a thought of how it might be better mobilized. Let's see, Jeff.
Maybe we can have Scott Bennett on the call.
Yeah, that would be great.
Great.
It would be fun. That would be really cool to have him on the call.
I know him personally. I've met with him at his home in Danville, California, so I can ask if you'd like.
Would you please, Mark? That would be very helpful. I think that would help move this discussion forward if we could get somebody who has this inside knowledge to converse with us about how we might better promote this understanding to the larger community.
Okay, I'll be happy to do that. I would like people to understand, though, that Scott Bennett is just a middleman. He doesn't have any direct knowledge. His claimed knowledge is from what he claims to have been tens of thousands of documents. If you can believe this claim, I can't. But he claims that when he was in a prison camp, I believe it was in Pennsylvania, with Fred Birkenfeld, for about 2 years, that first, it's not a coincidence that he was put there. But number two, he claims that Brad Birkenfeld had, in the prison camp, some like 20,000 documents from the UBS account proving all of fraud, and Scott Bennett told me over coffee in Danville, California, that he has access to these documents. Come on. I mean, I have the big question mark about Scott Bennett, but we can still hear him out.
Yeah. Good point. Okay. So, anything else on this subject before we move on to the other discussion?
It makes me wonder if WikiLeaks has found anything related to this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, let's move on to our final focus discussion. Recently, Cynthia McKinney was on Kevin Barrett's show. And at my request, he asked her if she would be willing to undertake a second 9/11 Citizens Commission hearing. And she said that if it were organized and funded, that she would. And that brings me to ask all of you what your thoughts are on this question, because it does seem to me that our big problem, or at least one of our big problems in the 9/11 Truth Movement, is, of course, the absence of a credible investigation of 9/11. And we could continue to take the tack of AE 9/11 Truth and continue to wait for Congress to act and give us that investigation, or we might decide that we should simply subsidize our own, do it independently with some credible panelists, and that's pretty much what I think was done in the first one. And I hope most of you are familiar with that, or if you weren't, that you clicked on the video that I embedded in the draft agenda. But it was a powerful set of testimonies that really probably represented the high point, I think, of the 9/11 Truth Movement's being so far, because it really got things rolling in terms of credible alternative proof of what was going on in 9/11. And it seems to me that if we had another of those with credible figures, that it would not only serve the 9/11 Truth Community's purposes, but it would at this point, perhaps, because of the changed atmosphere, awaken other people to the realities of these historical facts. So those are just my thoughts. And there's been a lot of water under the bridge since the first one, of course, so there would be quite a bit of catching up to do, but I'm sure we have lots of people that would make adequate witnesses and so forth. So does anybody want to comment on the thinking about whether we should be promoting that idea and thinking about organizing that or not?
I have a comment, Barb.
Barb and Dave, who else? All right, Barb, you first. Barbara, go ahead.
Oh, okay, thanks. Yeah, I was actually at those hearings. They were magnificent. I don't see a downside at all. If the funds can be raised, I think we should do it. And I think the perfect timing would be, I think many of us expect the imminent release of the 28 pages, and that's, of course, going to be framed to by the mainstream media and the powers that be to make it appear that it was just the Saudis who were the bad guys. You can close the book on 9/11. So the perfect timing would be to do it as soon as possible. I don't know where the funding is going to come from. I would like, I am totally in favor of it, so Cynthia is a friend and she's fantastic. I was at those hearings, and one thing that people should know is there were two hearings, not just one. And in the first one, the first main invitee was actually David Lee Griffin. But when you look at the video of the first of the two, he wasn't the speaker. And the reason for that was is that the Jersey girls, who were two or three of whom who were there and spoke, would not agree to speak at Cynthia's hearing, her first one, as it turned out. If there was any speaker who even hinted at his or her conclusion or hypothesis that it was an inside job. And so, because David Ray Griffin did exactly that, he had to be disinvited. So, it was terrible. But that's what happened, and Cynthia told me all this herself when we roomed together in New York City for one of the 9/11 conferences there. So, what she did was she had to hold a second one for David. And other people spoke as well, but it was a smaller hearing. It was also in one of the official house conference rooms. It was a magnificent official venue. And they were both very, very important events. But people should see both the videos of both of the hearings. That's my comment.
Barbara, do you have the links for those videos?
Well, I'd have to find them just like anybody else.
Okay. Well, I guess just go to YouTube and try. The only thing I was able to find were some snippets, large excerpts actually from the original one under this one fellow's YouTube channel. That's the only place I found them.
So I'll look when I get off the phone, and then I'll ask Cynthia if I can't find it.
Okay. Thank you. Dave?
Yes. When I brought Richard Gage to visit with Noam Chomsky in November, he proposed that we consider doing a Russell Tribunal-like event. And my threshold on this, as far as whether it's a good idea, is whether or not we're going to get more people to actually pay attention to it than the usual suspects, us. If we're just talking to ourselves, it's not worth the effort. If we have people who are respected enough intellectuals that it's going to be more broadly viewed, then it's more worthy. In general, that's my big complaint about our movement, is we just talk to each other. All the emails that people send and all the Facebook activity is basically just read by choir. We need to find ways to talk to people who are not yet with us.
Well, don't you think, David, that then might lead to the question of who would make credible panelists that would have a wider outreach based on their conclusions rather than those who are already familiar to the 9/11 truth movement?
I'm not sure there are many. I mean, I'm certainly open to there being credible panelists who have not yet spoken publicly. When Russell had his tribunal, which was about the Vietnam War, he wasn't a panelist. He was somebody who was sitting there listening to the people speak. And we need respected intellectuals to be willing to hear the same, probably mostly the same of us who have spoken before. It's just that if they are respected enough, then maybe more people would listen. I mean, frankly, Dario Fo, who was the Italian five-hour movie, New Pearl Harbor, he is a Nobel Prize winner in literature. So maybe Impossumato could help enlist Fo. Maybe we could find other Nobel laureates in Europe or anywhere in the world who would pull this together. I've wanted to reach out to a Nobel laureate who just won the chemistry prize this past year. He teaches at the University of North Carolina and Chapel Hill, and he's originally from Turkey, and even has made statements that he's not happy with the Western invasions of the Middle East. I wanted to get A.E.'s wonderful Beyond Misinformation booklet in his hands, But AE has a rule against generating a list of alums from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, which could conceivably get us a foot in the door. The issue is not who testifies. The issue is who is calling the hearing.
That's what I said. The panelists. The panelists would not be the people that are speaking. The panelists would be the people that are taking the hearing in and making a report.
Then we're in agreement.
There
we
go.
I propose Nobel laureate.
I've got to jump in. I've got to jump in here as far.
Yeah,
this
go ahead, Barbara.
Already happened. It was called the Toronto hearing. Judge Imposimoto, the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Italy, was one of the panelists. There were three highly credible professors, one from the United States, two from Canada, who were the panelists who listened to all of the presentations. And even beyond Cynthia McKinney's two hearings, when she was a member of Congress, which were magnificent, extremely important, that didn't produce a document. It didn't produce a proceedings or a book, whereas the Toronto hearings did. It's a magnificent book. You can buy it on Amazon, the 9/11 Toronto Report. Every single one.
I agree. It's great, but we need...
It's great, and... So
people, even bigger than Imposimoto, to stand for this. We need Nobel laureates.
Well, I guess, Barbara, I hear your point, but I'm thinking that to appeal to an American electorate, these would have to be people who, I mean, there's an argument to be made for making it on an international basis, and there's an argument to be made to be making it focused on trying to gain credibility to an American audience, which might be different, okay? So I hear what you're saying, but I think it needs to be looked at from both perspectives.
Well, I agree. When we get to the announcements, I'm going to let everybody know the exciting news about the 9/11 conference in New York City on September 10th and 11th,
okay.
Which will address this.
Okay. Well, good. Maybe that'll help move to discussion. Well,
maybe you can get the Pope to go.
Yeah, well, there's a stellar...
Danny Sheehan went with me to meet with Judge Imposimoto last October and is meeting with the Pope in mid-July.
Well, shoot the moon.
Okay, so let's think about coming back to our question, perhaps another teleconference if there's interest. It's time for announcements. Barbara, I know you have one. Who else has an announcement?
Dave Schlesinger.
Dave, and who else? Wayne, did you want to make an announcement? Are you still on the call?
Yes, I'd like to make an announcement.
Okay, and I have an announcement. And anybody else?
Yeah, Pat.
Pat? I'm
yeah.
Sorry. Okay, and anybody else? Okay, Barbara, go ahead, sir.
Okay, well, you know, people may want to ask questions, and we don't have the detailed agendas yet. People are still being invited and have not responded. We should have the agenda, the program for the New York City conference event probably in 2 weeks. And Les Jamison will be putting those out to everybody, and once I get it, just in case he hasn't sent it to the 9/11 telecon list, I will do so. But here's the bottom line. There will be two events. This is a big conference worldwide for the 50th anniversary. In New York City, we've just obtained a really prominent venue. It will be at Columbia University in the Faculty Club. I believe that's called the Faculty House, technically. It will be on Saturday, September 11th and Saturday, September 10th and Sunday, September 11th, beginning. Doors open at 9 a.m. each day. Events each day start at 10 a.m. Saturday and Sunday, going to probably 6, maybe even 6:30 p.m. With a break for lunch. And what's happening on Saturday as well as Sunday, the first Saturday, Les Jamison each year organizes a conference in New York City, and that will be his day. I was asked to invite Judge Imposimoto and also world-famous attorney Daniel Sheehan, and both have accepted. They will both be speaking both days. I'll get to Sunday in a moment. So the conference on Saturday the 10th will include Judge Imposimoto and Daniel Sheehan and Wayne Matson and Barry Kissen and, we hope, William Pepper, and I could go on and on, and covering all aspects of 9/11, of course, focusing on the World Trade Center. So that's the first day. That's the conference that we always hold with some really prominent names of good high credibility. The really exciting new development for the movement is the second day, which is Sunday, September 11th. I'll be speaking at that, and I've again arranged for Judge Quasimodo and Daniel Sheehan to be speaking. And what this event is, I'm not sure what the exact event will end up being, but it's being put on, organized, and sponsored by a group that's been meeting for about the past year and a half. It's called, if I have the title correctly, the 9/11 Attorneys Investigation Committee, or Committee on Investigations. And this was originally Richard Gage's idea and proposal, although it's completely separate and independent from architects and engineers. And it's headed by Jane Clark, who's a personal friend with whom I went to Rome with Jane last October. And it's also being, the main organizer is attorney Nick Harrison. Nick Harrison, at my request, wrote a magnificent law review article on the applicability of the seat for debate clause to the release of the 28 pages by any member of Congress being fully protected by that part of the Constitution. And there is a new 28 pages resolution that, I think it's 779, but anyway, put in the hopper in the House of Representatives, which explicitly calls upon Congress to use the speech or debate clause to itself declassify and release the 28 pages if the Obama executive branch does not do so. So that's a tremendous victory and success. So on Sunday, Judge Quasimodo, Daniel Sheehan, William Pepper will be the moderator, Nick Harrison, Jane Clark, and other top attorneys will be discussing all day long with a break for lunch all of the aspects of bringing the real perpetrators to justice. The evidence of what happened, the strongest evidence to bring into court, what the venue should be, whether it could reasonably ever happen in the United States, whether it's the European, Canadian, international, and the pros and cons of all of that so that the legal rubber can finally meet the road. So I'm really excited about the second day of this conference.
Barbara, thank you so much for that, because that really does sort of tie in with what we were just talking about, and maybe that is the venue in which this question can be really discussed
deeply. Yes, I think that we should revisit it after that shared knowledge base, and I hope everyone goes to the conference, and especially the legal panel to that on Sunday.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited about it.
Oh, it will be live streamed.
It will be live streamed. Yay! Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to take issue with one thing Barbara said.
Well, Dave, it's your turn, so go ahead.
Okay, I'll be quick about that. The attorneys group was not founded by Richard Gage. He authorized its founding. The person who actually is the founder.
It was not his idea.
It was the idea of Susan Watkins, who is the volunteer for AE, who committed suicide soon after she was so viciously treated. They actually tried to shut that meeting down. I facilitated the first couple of meetings. Richard did authorize its founding. Without him, it wouldn't have happened. But she is the originator. Anyway.
Thank you for that. I agree with that. That's true. But she is no longer with us, terribly, unfortunately. Richard is behind this group, but it is...
Good. I understand. I agree.
I didn't say he founded it. I didn't say that.
Okay. Very good. Anyway, what I really wanted to say is that I'm urging people to go to Quora.com to look at the questions and answers there where you can weigh in on 9/11 matters. I am read by about 500 people a day. I've been read now by 150,000 people. Many of you are much better researchers than I am. It has enforced civility, and most importantly, a significant percentage of the readers are from outside the U.S., so they are not caught up in American exceptionalism. I'm stopped dialoguing with debunkers. If they want to comment on what I say, that's fine. But there are a tremendous number of questions about 9/11 issues, and it's ridiculous for me to be so isolated. Brian Good and I are about the only people I know from the movement who regularly weigh in. It's called Quora.com, Q-U-O-R-A.com.
Yeah, within Quora.com, can you tell us or let us know by email what particular subject we would go to under Quora? Plug in.
I will prepare something to email to this group. Basically, you go and you. I don't answer just questions about 9/11. I mean, I'm interested in nonviolence and climate change, et cetera, et cetera. But you go and you answer whatever questions you want, and can ask whatever questions you want. The point is that it's ridiculous for me and Brian Good to be doing almost everything on behalf of the people who.
My question was within Quora, which is huge. If you could try to let us know where to zero in on the 9/11 related area and how to get there.
Well, I'm so intimately connected, but I will look that up and answer your question. It's a fair question.
Yeah, for everybody.
Yeah, just email us to 911 telecom. Okay, then.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Let's see. Wayne is next.
Yeah, so what I wanted to announce was that we our website, 911truthoutreach.org, has an events calendar now that allows people who are registered with the site the events calendar to post events that are happening around the country. The goal is to make it so that people who want to see that there's activity going on and will feel empowered to go out and do some other activism work. So if you go to 911truthoutreach.org, you can register and then register on the website, and then you can, if you send me an email, we'll get you access to be able to post events. That's all. I'll take questions if there are any. Thanks.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions about 911 Truth Outreach's activity calendar?
I'll be getting you the information or ask Les to as soon as we have more detail on the conference in New York.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Wayne. And I'd like to also announce a website. Due to the controversy inside of the 28 Pages movement, a number of us have decided that there needs to be a recontextualization of the 28 Pages in terms of 9/11 truth, and we've talked about this several times on this teleconference, but we have now our own website. It's called 28pagesrevealed.info. That's 28pagesrevealed.info. And it gets a different take on the 28 pages, still supporting, of course, their release, but in the context of understanding that it's, we're its own history, it's limited, it's likely limited nature, and, some criticism of the folks that are trying to present it as being the end-all and be-all of the 9/11 truth, which it can't possibly be. But in any case, we will encourage people to take a look at the website and give us comments if you have any, okay? 28pagesrevealed.info. Okay, Kat, you're last.
Yes, I'd just like to alert everyone to Bill Pepper's book that's out now. It's really explosive about his 40-year research into the assassination of Martin Luther King. There's a 2-hour interview on Gary Knoll. If you go to GaryKnoll.com and search around, you'll find it. It's really worth listening to, and obviously everyone read the book. and hopefully we can have a discussion of the book at some point in this conference call. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome to propose that at some point, Kat. And while you mentioned Gary Null, I'd like to encourage people also to check out his interviews with Danny Sheehan. He had a 4-part series of interviews with Danny Sheehan that are outstanding and really worth your while. So if you get to his website, be sure to check those out too.
And could I add?
I'm sorry, a Barb.
And I do have one other announcement.
Before you do, can I just make a quick comment on the previous one before you jump to the next one?
Sure.
Who is
it? Okay, it's Craig.
Oh, Craig. Yeah, go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm going to be interviewing William Pepper for an article on Truth and Shadows in the next few days. I'm just reading the book now, and we'll probably be speaking to him sometime next week. So hopefully I'll have an article on that book, which I imagine is going to be, which I know is going to be quite explosive, at least within our community, if not the mainstream one. But anyway, just wanted to throw that in.
Well, let me ask both you and if I could before Barb talks again. Is there more in this than in his past books? I mean, are there new revelations?
Yes. There are.
Okay. Well, good. I'll have to get them. All right. Thank you. Barb?
Yeah, that's really great news about the William Pepper interview. Look forward to that. And everybody needs to hear the Gary Null about William Pepper and also the 4 interviews in a row with Daniel Sheehan, S-A-T-E.
Yeah, I already mentioned that, Barbara.
State and the Nazis. Well, my last announcement is that I will be interviewed tomorrow night, that Thursday night at midnight, going into Friday, July 1st, for 2 hours from midnight to 2 a.m. on the Richard Hoagland show. I'll tell you how to listen to it if you're interested. It will be all on 9/11 for 2 hours, and usually it's heard in 100 countries worldwide. And if you're interested in listening, and it will be archived, but you have to pay $5 for a month subscription to hear it if you don't hear it live. You can hear it live tomorrow, Thursday night at midnight going into early Friday morning at www.theothersideofmidnight.com.
Midnight what time zone, Barbara?
Oh, thank you. California. So you'll have to do the math. Yeah. Midnight California to 2 a.m. California time tomorrow, Thursday, late night, going into Friday morning.
That would be 3 a.m. Pacific, 3
a.m.
Eastern.
To 5 a.m. Eastern, yeah.
Are they archived, Barbara, the shows?
I'm sorry, what?
Are the shows archived so that people can listen at another time?
They are, but if you don't listen live, you do have to subscribe for at least a month for $5. It is well worth it. He has interviews there with phenomenal guests. I mean, just listening to the James Farrell interview on his book, that we were just talking about, would be sufficient for the $5. But you have a whole month to listen to all over 200 of his interviews so far.
Okay. Well, I think that wraps it up for tonight. We went a little over time, but that couldn't be helped. We had a lot on our agenda. So, again, next month, we hopefully will have the debate, the long-awaited debate between Barb and Craig, and presumably, sorry, Craig, I keep forgetting who your partner is.
Adam
Ruff, and
that's if I agree to debate two people.
If presumably. Okay, so we'll do that next month, and then the following month will again be open for other agenda items. Okay, so we'll see you for that event last Wednesday in July. And have a good month, everybody. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.